Karen is rejoining the court, so we will proceed. Is it Mr. Sieben?
It is, Your Honor.
Good morning to you.
Good
morning. You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is James Sieben, and I, along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Carraher, represent the appellant juvenile in this case, a 16-year-old by the name of Zoe. At the time of this incident and at the time of the filing and the trial, Zoe was 15 years old. Based on the charge that was filed, Zoe was liable to be penalized further under a new addition to the Nebraska Revised Statute, Section 28-1204.05, which I will refer to as the Prohibited Juvenile Offender Statute.
Counsel, you've described it already as a penalty, and I want to visit with you about that. This court's decision in State v. Peters back in 2001 held that criminalizing the possession of firearms by those convicted of felonies didn't amount to punishment for those prior felonies, that instead it was a not to punish but to protect the public. Are you asking us to overrule that case in connection with your arguments today?
I'm not asking the court to overrule that case.
How do you distinguish it?
I would distinguish it simply because in juvenile court, the stated purpose of juvenile court, both in case law and in the Nebraska Revised Statute, is to be rehabilitative, to be a court where juveniles are attempted to be removed from the criminal process. This statute, this new statute, the Prohibited Juvenile Offender Statute, not only is it not rehabilitative, there's no rehabilitative purpose to the statute, it's solely done, even if there is a public safety aspect, it's solely done, and the legislative history suggests that it's done to keep firearms out of these juveniles, no matter if they're charged with a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence or a felony.
But if it's not a punishment in the adult criminal context, how can it be a punishment in the juvenile adjudication context?
I would argue that it becomes a punishment because when you're not afforded the full due process of rights, and when you remove any attempt to rehabilitate, the statute makes no attempt to rehabilitate, you have what amounts to the restriction of a fundamental individual right that equates to a hindrance. It equates to a punishment that you can no longer possess a firearm in a legal manner to hunt or fish, or I'm sorry, not fish, but to hunt or protect yourself or to use for recreational sport. So even if it's not a punishment by the definition in Peters, it acts in a way that is sufficiently similar to a punishment. And further, if charged as an adult, it comes with it's a felony charge, and therefore it comes with the punishment of potential prison time, obviously felony convictions are something that would negatively affect someone. And the ban is total, it's complete. While there is a way to achieve the right back, there is no immediate way to do so, and the right
is... What do you mean by that?
Well, if someone is, like in this case, it's an attempted felony theft, class 3A, upon adjudication, until the age of 25, there is a presumptive ban on possessing a firearm. Now, there is a mechanism to get that right back, just like there would be in adult court.
And to apply either in juvenile court if you're under 19, or to apply to the district court if you've reached the age of majority, right?
Correct.
Is there any time limit on making that motion? Could a youth make the motion right away under the statute?
I believe the youth could. I highly doubt it would be successful. I would indicate that based on the language in the legislative history that was cited in the appellee's brief, that the intent of the law is to restrict their access to firearms. And
as punishment for the crime or to protect the public going forward?
I think it could be looked at both ways. And obviously, there are three issues in this case. The third issue is whether or not there was adequate proof beyond a reasonable doubt to determine that the value of the item that was attempted to be stolen was over $5,000. I would state to this court that if the court agrees with the appellant's argument that that was not proven beyond a reasonable doubt and that a lesser included misdemeanor crime is the more appropriate adjudication, then the court does not need to address the other two assignments of error. The other two assignments of error revolving around the motion to quash that was filed as well as the jury demand are juxtaposed against each other. We're not asking that the court find both of them to be errors, but one or the other has to be an error. And regarding first the motion to quash, I would state to the court that there's no doubt that this new statute affects a fundamental right. D.C. v. Heller, McDonald v. City of Chicago indicate that this new law, the Prohibited Juvenile Offender Statute, clearly restricts a constitutional right.
Is this the proper time to be challenging that?
Yes. I would state to the court that there's no other proper time to challenge it.
How about when Zoe would be charged with it later or through a, you know, a declaration action later or one of the other proceedings that are available under the statute?
Well, I would cite State v. Albrecht, which in a case that was procedurally similar, the statutes obviously weren't similar, but a case that was procedurally similar, the Court of Appeals held that because the statute that affected possible sentences was not that a motion to quash was not waived prior to that conviction taking place, that challenging that statute had been waived. And I would also say that from a policy perspective, it makes more sense to allow this motion to quash to continue now, because if, as the court suggested, they could be challenged when prosecuted under that statute, then the individual in any case would either have to risk felony prosecution or go without a fundamental individual right. So,
what about a declaratory judgment action?
A declaratory judgment action is something that I guess could be proceeded with if the court found the motion to quash was improper, but I still think it makes sense to determine before the sentence is in place, before the additional statute goes into effect, to determine whether or not whether it's a punishment or whether it's a civil disability is constitutional in the first place. Regarding the jury trial, the jury trial demand, I would note that the new prohibited juvenile offender statute makes all felonies and misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence in juvenile court a serious crime. I would cite a new case out of Nebraska called Anderson v. I believe it's 8th Judicial District Court.
Do you mean Nevada?
Sorry. I do mean Nevada. I apologize. And yes, where the law previously was for a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, a maximum term of 6 months, the court held that is not a serious offense.
This serious offense analysis is a Sixth Amendment analysis, correct?
Yes.
But are we even in the Sixth Amendment world for juvenile proceedings? Doesn't the Supreme Court's opinion, and I think it's McIver, doesn't that hold that juvenile court is different and whatever protections are available arise out of what's required by due process?
I do agree that that is what McIver says. However, this new prohibition fundamentally changes the analysis of McIver. As I mentioned earlier, the fact that this is not rehabilitative, the fact that this is purely done either for the safety of the public or for punitive measures, makes the analysis in this case and the amount analysis in all cases different than the analysis in McGuire.
But juvenile court, I mean, setting aside this statute, juveniles can be detained, correct?
Yes.
And that's for the benefit of the public. And that doesn't change, McIver held that that doesn't make juvenile proceedings criminal proceedings.
I would argue that in a juvenile detention hearing. They are not subject to a period of incarceration, whether that be 6 months or more. They're subject to incarceration for a limited period of time until a placement is found for them or until they have the adequate treatment plan in place to be released. So I think the difference is it's not a sentence. You aren't sentenced to the juvenile detention center. I would argue that if that was possible, then there would be a Sixth Amendment issue. And the Confrontation Clause applies, which the Confrontation Clause applies in juvenile cases, in trials in juvenile cases. So the Sixth Amendment has been interpreted to apply in juvenile cases
before. Let me circle back to your reference to the Anderson case out of Nevada. That was not a juvenile case, right? That was a misdemeanor that got denominated serious, and therefore the state Supreme Court said, well, now you get a jury.
Your Honor, may I answer the
question? You may answer.
Your Honor, that is correct.
So what's the lesson?
The lesson is that the reason why it was determined to be a serious offense was the firearm prohibition. That was the only change in the law that occurred. The legislature in Nevada created a law making this offense and made it come with the additional...
Notwithstanding, it was a misdemeanor. It got serious, therefore, a jury.
Yes, it got serious because of the firearm ban.
Because the legislature denominated it serious.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
I am out of time. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Norrie, good morning to you.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Mary Norrie and I represent the state of Nebraska, the appellee in this case. As I think it's pretty obvious from the briefs, there's several intensive issues involving in this case, but the one I would like to start with is the issue of the notice to the Attorney General and how that was not given. It is the state's position that appellants move for a declaratory judgment.
Have we ever required notice to the Attorney General when a defendant files a motion to quash?
Not always, not in all cases, not if it's just a motion to quash. However, this motion to quash was for a collateral statute and not the statute that was actually on the face of the petition. In those cases, when declaratory judgment is being sought, it is necessary to give notice to the Attorney General so that they can enter their appearance and be heard. Given that the Attorney General was a necessary party at the lower level and they were not
a necessary party based on the declaratory judgment statute? Based on what?
Based on the declaratory judgment, the fact that they needed to be given notice, and at that point it's their decision if they want to enter their appearance and be involved in the case. But
aren't
the fact
we in
that
an entirely different framework?
No, because this is civil. Juvenile court is a court of civil authority. So that's, I think, what's caused a lot of confusion on this appeal is appellant is asserting that this is all now criminal. And a lot of the case law appellant has asserted is criminal case law. But that is not applicable to juveniles in juvenile court. They're civil proceedings.
Does a separate juvenile court have jurisdiction to entertain a declaratory judgment action?
I believe they do if all parties are given the appropriate notice, and that's part of the issue here as far as if this was properly preserved for appeal or not. If all
where would you find that jurisdiction in our statutes or our Constitution?
Your Honor, in 25-21159, it's municipal parties for the Attorney General, it does discuss the notice that must be given to the Attorney General for these cases.
Right. I'm talking about where in our Constitution or our statutes do you find authority for the proposition that the separate juvenile court has authority over declaratory judgments, challenging the constitutionality of a statute?
I don't know of anything that specifically states that. They are full vested judges, so it could be something for this court to determine. There's obviously a lot of first impression in this case, but if the court didn't have the authority to hear that, even if this was properly preserved for appeal, it is the state's position that the statute is constitutional regardless.
Doesn't the county attorney's office perform the function of the attorney general's office in these kinds of proceedings?
I don't know if that would apply to juvenile court, Your Honor. The Attorney General is specifically the Attorney General, and they were not given notice, and so that is the state's position. Again, regardless, even if this was properly preserved for appeal, it is the state's position that the appellant has failed to meet their burden of showing that this statute is, in fact, unconstitutional. The state argues that intermediate scrutiny is the appropriate level that would be applicable, and I think it's clear from the legislative debates that public safety was the primary purpose of the creation of this statute.
Intermediate scrutiny to review what?
The appellant is challenging it under the Second Amendment, arguing that it is a fundamental right to possess firearms and that this statute infringes upon that fundamental right. Given that Second Amendment, there is some debate amongst the courts as to what level of scrutiny is appropriate. The state argues that it's intermediate, but we also argue that even if strict scrutiny is what is applicable, the statute would still pass the constitutional test.
So the trial court resolved the motion to quash finding primarily on ripeness. What's the state's position with respect to that?
The state's position is that it is not ripe because until a juvenile is adjudicated, for one, the statute would not even be applicable to said juvenile. Furthermore, our analysis is that it's similar to the Sex Offender Registry Act in that it is a collateral civil consequence. And so until that is actually violated, until a juvenile actually does possess a firearm, that the issue is not ripe until that point, because that's when the additional prosecution could occur.
They have to risk criminal prosecution in order to challenge the constitutionality of the statute.
It's very similar to SORA, Your Honor. And again, juveniles have the opportunity to apply for exemption from this statute. There is no time limit on when they need to do that. There is no limit on how many times the juvenile could do that. And the judge who considers that has essentially can consider all the factors of that individual case to see if that juvenile still needs this prohibition applied to them for the sake of public safety. So it is narrowly tailored regardless.
Could this juvenile have applied to the juvenile court in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe this juvenile could have. Immediately following adjudication would likely be the appropriate time because that's when the prohibition is implemented onto the juvenile. At that point, the juvenile can present evidence to the court as to why the prohibition should not apply to the juvenile based on that juvenile's history, the facts of the case, the underlying adjudication. The statute's clear that the court can basically consider all factors in determining if this is someone who needs to have this prohibition applied to them for the sake of public safety or not. Your Honor, essentially what the state is arguing is that the statute is narrowly tailored, even if we are looking at a strict scrutiny analysis, partly because of some of the things I've just discussed. The juvenile can ask to be exempted. It automatically ends at age 25, which the legislative floor debate made it clear that the purpose of that is juvenile brain development. At the age of 25, the human brain is fully developed and you have less of those concerns with impulsive behaviors. It's also narrowed in the fact that this does only apply to juveniles adjudicated on felony level offenses and offenses of third degree domestic assault, which is by nature can be a violent offense. Furthermore, juveniles are not denied due process rights throughout this process. They do have the right to have a trial, go before a judge, they have the right to remain silent, confront, cross-examine witnesses, all those traditional rights, but for the right to a jury trial. The juvenile courts exist specifically through statute, and the code specifically says juveniles do not have a right to a trial by jury, so I don't believe that there's any due process violation there.
The goal of the statute is to protect the public from firearms offenses by juveniles that have engaged in dangerous behavior. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's why it was narrowed to felony level offenses and offenses of third degree domestic violence.
Why would every felony in the world, many of which do not involve violence at all, or any suggestion of violence, and this one perhaps arguably, theft by unlawful taking, is not inherently a violent act. What's the rational connection between every felony and the firearms prohibition?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a couple prongs to that answer. First of all, I don't know how the legislature could predict which felonies it should or should not apply to because the underlying aspects of what happens, the factual basis of that felony, is going to differ from case to case.
Couldn't they have said any felony involving violence?
They likely could have, but the felony itself doesn't necessarily involve violence. In this case, we're talking about a theft. A theft inherently doesn't involve or not involve violence.
So what's the predictive value of a felony conviction for theft by unlawful taking that would suggest that a firearms limitation needs to be in place.
And that's where the actual judge can make that determination of if the juvenile should be exempted or not. They can look at the facts of that case and see if violence was involved or not. In this case,
after request, though, right? You can't just exempt them out outright.
Yes, Your Honor. They have to make that request, but part of what we're talking about, too, is, again, it goes back to that juvenile brain development until the age of 25 is the impulsivity of behaviors. These are juveniles who have shown that they're committing felony-level offenses. They have those impulsive behaviors that they're acting on.
Well, this case is a carjacking, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, high probability of violence in a carjacking.
Yes, Your Honor, and the facts in the Bill of Exceptions do show that there was assaultive behaviors by the juvenile in an attempt to take this car. Furthermore, we're talking about a juvenile who, as appellant has pointed out, was not 16 at the time, therefore would not have had a valid driver's license. There's an inherent danger right there when you have juveniles stealing vehicles and driving them without having license to do so. There's been cases recently in this county where juveniles have been killed engaging in such behavior. So I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to expect the legislature to have been able to pinpoint every single possible felonies and determine which are considered more violent and which are not, given that how the felony is committed is relevant.
Okay, so forgery? That forge a check of a large enough amount that justifies taking away a firearm?
It could depend on the facts of that case. That one is probably more likely to not have violence attached to it. But again, that's where the juvenile can request to be exempted.
Does the exemption procedure give any direction to the judge as to what they're to consider as in deciding whether to grant an exemption?
Yes, Your Honor. It does talk about the judge being able to look and see how the juvenile has been rehabilitated. If they have or not, they can look, and essentially it can look at any factors they want to. So it seems natural that they would look at the underlying facts of that particular case. They'd look and see how the juvenile has progressed since that time. This does not mean that juvenile court is not rehabilitative. Juveniles still enter into terms of probation where multitude of services targeted and designed to rehabilitate them are put into place. All of those are factors that the judge, either at the district court or the juvenile court level, can consider when determining if a juvenile is to be exempted or not.
There's been some reference to adult convictions, just to put to contrast that with the juvenile line of cases. What happens in the adult convictions if there's a firearms restriction? So if it's a felony, then there'll be a restriction on firearms?
To clarify, that do you
would
mean...
Not, that would be, say, in a probation order, and it wouldn't be waivable, is that right? But if it was for a misdemeanor, it wouldn't automatically be imposed.
First of all, I'm out of time. Is it okay if I answer?
You may answer.
Exactly. It doesn't even apply to misdemeanors because those aren't considered to be as serious of offenses, and you don't have as much of the public safety concerns as you do when you're talking about juveniles committing felonies.
Whether or not a firearms restriction is imposed on a misdemeanor, rightly or wrongly, there is a mechanism for relief?
Yes, Your Honor.
If they're on probation?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how about with somebody convicted of a felony in the adult circumstance?
I'm less familiar with the adult circumstance. Again, I don't think we've had any juveniles get to that point yet because this is so new and this is first impression. But at that point, if you're charged as an adult with a crime, especially if it's a felony level offense, you'll likely get a public defender or you'll have that right to counsel and you'll have your due process in that case. So this doesn't create a person a felony as an adult. It's simply one element that the state would have to prove in pursuing a potential future charge.
If it's an adjudicated juvenile who has done something that would be felony level, he or she has the opportunity to be relieved of a firearms restriction.
Yes, Your Honor. Even if they're past the age of 19, at that point they simply must make that petition to the district court as opposed to the juvenile court judge. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is State v. Case,